This is a CBC podcast.
I'll tell you this story. I had this guy come up to me and he says to me, "What reserve are you from?" I said, "I don't come from reserve." He said, "Well, your family, what reserve they come from?" I said, "My family did not come from reserve." "Well, yeah, you people came from reserve. You were born in a reserve." I said, "No, I wasn't." He says, "Did you live in Winnipeg all your life? Did your mom and dad live in Winnipeg?" I said, "Yes, they came from St. Norbert." "No, I don't know before that, you know." And I said, "Okay." I said, "You want to know what reserve I'm from?" I said, "I'm from Roostertown." "Roostertown? Never heard of that reserve. Never heard of that reserve." I said, "You know where the Pan Am Pool is?" I said, "That's where Roostertown is." "Well, there's no reserve there." I says, "Well, that's where I'm from."
Frank Sayas was born in Roostertown, July 1st, 1942. Roostertown was a small Métis community that formed on the outskirts of Winnipeg in 1901. It wasn't a reserve, but I imagine that the man who asked Frank about his reserve asked because many First Nation people lived on reserves, and Frank looks like he could be First Nation.
In those days, there was no such thing as Métis. You're either Indian or half-breed. And like I heard that the other day on the radio, somebody was called a half-breed, and they said that was pretty hurtful words. And they were Métis, just like I am.
I'm Stephanie Cram, host of Muddied Water, 1870, Homeland of the Métis, Episode 3, Roostertown. Roostertown was a Métis settlement that existed between 1901 and the late 1950s in southwest Winnipeg. It's one of many Métis settlements that formed and fought for survival as Canada continued to settle the West. And as we'll hear from Frank Sayas in this episode, the destruction of communities like Roostertown had a lasting impact. Where you come from is an important part of how you identify as a Métis person. Me, I'm from Alberta, with family ties to Lac St. Anne, a mostly Métis community. It's also not a reserve. Rather, it's a community that just so happens to have a rich Métis history. Now, talking about Roostertown has me thinking about something truly unique about my home province, the Métis settlements. It's the first and only stretch of land in Canada completely owned and controlled by an Indigenous group. When my parents were married in 1974, they were poor and saving money to buy their first house. My mom tells me that she suggested to my dad that they should apply for a stretch of land in the Métis settlements, but my city-dwelling father scoffed at the idea. To this day, I wonder how my life would be different if I was born in the settlements, if I grew up in a Métis community surrounded by culture. But then again, a place to call home isn't always enough as Métis people, because history tells us that in a moment, that home could be gone.
Oh, it was pure chance, pure lucky chance.
That's Evelyn Peters, who stumbled on the story of Roostertown through her work as a Canada Research Chair and professor at the University of Winnipeg.
I had some research assistants working on the manuscript census for 1901, and they found a record of this 1901 community in quotes in the bush. And one of the research assistants had grown up in Winnipeg and had heard about Roostertown. So he was really interested. So I said, "Well, see what's available." And we found virtually nothing.
Evelyn and her team started combing through municipal records to put Roostertown literally back on the map and determine the families that lived there.
It was a series of houses that were scattered, and many of them were quite far away from each other, scattered through the largely brush and prairie that existed in that area. And we found some area photos that showed paths between the houses. There were no roads, there was no indoor plumbing, no electricity, none of the city infrastructure. Getting water was always a huge...
I started hauling water.
It was a huge issue.
The first pump that I can remember that was on Weatherden and Wilson, that was the first pump.
Frank had a couple of horses, I think it was.
Well, we had a horse. We had a horse.
And two big barrels.
And we were charging 75 cents a barrel.
And that's how he would take water, especially to the people living further west, because there were no good wells there. That wasn't an area where it was easy to dig wells. And the city refused to extend water through the settlement at that point in time.
It's hard to imagine what is now the Fort Rouge neighborhood in Winnipeg as a place where you'd need to haul water. From the archival photos and even building permits, we can see that many of the houses were handmade shanties, which in some ways kind of look like the modern, in-fashion, tiny houses of today. There were also standard bungalows and even two-story houses, some of which were so well constructed, they are still standing. Initially, the houses were spread out in clusters, but the community became more centralized as time went on.
So at the time when the community was dissolved, there was a cluster on Ash and Oak Street across Keniston. And then there was another cluster that was exactly where the Grant Park Mall was. And then actually by 1961, the Ash and the Oak Street residents had moved across the street to a couple of streets near the Grant Park Mall. And that's they bought houses and they lived near each other there.
One of the difficulties in gathering information about Roostertown was that no one who lived there wants to speak about it.
Frank later told me that he really did not want to talk to either of us because he thought we were going to reproduce the stereotypes that the newspapers had printed in the 1950s.
We were called bootleggers. We were called everybody lived on welfare.
The newspapers saw this as a homogeneous community. Everyone was poor, living in shanties, dirty, on welfare. And, I mean, clearly there was deep poverty there. I don't want to gloss that over. But there were also small, well-maintained houses, well-dressed children. The photos show people, beautiful family photos of families that were obviously very close. The myth that all the men were on welfare was absolutely false, as we know from the existing censuses and also from the voters lists that men worked. When men weren't around, then the women worked. You know, the only thing the newspapers wanted to talk about was parties, gambling, bootlegging, fights. And I mean, that was a small part of Roostertown, but it certainly didn't represent sort of daily life or most of the community.
And I mean, there was a few parties. Like, I mean, what I tell everybody, they used to start their, if they were having a party, they used to start their party on Thursday and it ended on Sunday. And there was a few fights. But, you know, after Monday, everybody's going to work and everything, they were still friends. You know, nobody got hurt.
Frank's stories of Roostertown have become an important part of Evelyn's research.
Frank started to come to the talks that I did, and when I finished, I would turn it over to him, and he would entertain the audience with stories about Roostertown. And, you know, very often had them laughing hilariously. But he was a really good storyteller. Well, he still is.
Here's one story Frank likes to tell about his father.
Well, it wasn't funny at the time. My mother and dad, their bed was right there beside the window, and my mother was sleeping one night, and all of a sudden, I guess the guy pulled her hairs up, and all of a sudden she got up, Dad, hey, there's somebody there, there's a man there. My dad gets up, what the heck is going on here? When he says, so the guy just pokes his head, he says, can you spare me a glass of water, or can I trouble you for a piece of bread or something? My dad said, okay, stay right there, I'll be right there. He says, so my dad got dressed and everything, went outside, brought him in the house, and my mother lit the lamp. You know, we had a lamp, we had electricity, lit the lamp. So my dad says, well, cook me something to eat. The guy said he hasn't eaten for 2 or 3 days or something like that. He said, And they tell him that he came from the tracks. Well, I use this word hobo. That's not nice to say. So we fed him and everything, and my mother made him some sandwich, and away he went. My dad was always that type of guy. He never refused anything, anybody.
Frank lived in Roostertown until he was 17 years old. Then the city of Winnipeg kicked his family out.
My mother, in 1960, went to City Hall to pay her tax. And when she got there, they said, "You don't own that property. That belongs to the parks." Well, they were building their Grand Park High School there then. And so my mother came home, told my dad. And my dad, what I call him, my Uncle Ed, but he's actually my first cousin. And they went and seen him, and they all went to my mother and my Uncle Ed and my Auntie Vi. They all went to City Hall. They wanted to talk to Cuba. My cousin showed them that my dad cleared title. And they said, "How could you kick people out this land? That's their land." Then I guess they realized they made a mistake. My dad had one lot. At that time, I think maybe it was worth maybe $150, $200, $300, I don't know. But he got $1,250 for it.
The city moved them into the North End, and from the evidence, we tried to trace them through newspaper records and, all kinds of records. And it was really, really clear that they received worse housing when the city moved them. So there are records of fires. Frank, at one point, took his kids to see all of the places they had lived in the North End, because the places were so bad, they had to move quite frequently. The other thing that happened was that people who had jobs nearby, they worked at the florist shop, they worked at the writing studio, and they worked at the milk processing plant. They either lost their jobs or they had to commute long, long distances every morning to retain them. So they really lost out. And they lost out on a sense of community. Frank's parents owned their house, and they were kicked out and never owned a house again. Yeah, it was almost like they were dispossessed again.
Understanding what the residents of Roostertown were up against in 1960 goes all the way back to 1870 with the Manitoba Act. If you recall from episode 1, 1.4 million acres were promised to Métis people, but that promise was broken.
Well, the Métis at the time when Manitoba joined Confederation were extremely concerned that they would lose their lands. So Louis Riel and the other people with them negotiated in the Manitoba Act that the Métis would get title to their lands and that they would be able to settle near each other. And that didn't happen. And the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples talked about the fact that Métis were dispossessed and that the provincial and the federal government failed to live up to the promises under the Manitoba Act. So when we looked to see whether the people who ended up in Roostertown or their ancestors had received title to land, almost uniformly they hadn't.
Here's Jean Taillet, who we met in episode 1.
The Métis really did believe for a long time, I would say for about 6 years, that this was actually going to happen. And in the beginning, they actually had all these meetings, big family meetings, and they put posts in the ground to mark out the lands that they wanted in what they called en bloc, meaning sort of like reserves. They called them reserves. And they were meant to be like family holdings, large family holdings, because that's the way the Métis grouped themselves, is as family groupings. And they were told that this is how it would work. And then all of a sudden, this decision came down from Ottawa, just out of the blue, that said, nope, they're all going to be done by lottery. And that was, I call it death by a thousand cuts. It was just the end of the Métis being able to live the way they had always wanted to live, which was in these family groupings. And then there were other things, the delays. There's a lottery. They were, even when they were doing it by lottery, at best it should take a week. It should take maybe a month, 7 years, and they still hadn't distributed the land. So what happens then is more and more settlers are coming in, and they're settling on these lands, and the lands are disappearing. And then there's the reign of terror going on, and there's the brutality and the hatred of the people who are coming from Ontario. Winnipeg is a racist, bigoted, disgustingly violent little town for the Métis after the Manitoba Act comes into place. It's no wonder they left. And it's interesting that you talk about Roostertown, because Roostertown is one of those what we call road allowance communities, right? And what happens is that as they do get taken up for roads, the people have to pick up and leave and move. And Winnipeg was quite sure that they did not want Indigenous people living in a group downtown in what they considered to be a slum.
What happened in Roostertown was unfortunately not unique. Métis communities similar to it popped up across the prairies. In the early years of Canada, the Métis didn't fit in new settler cities, and they didn't belong on reserves. So they created their own communities on unused Crown land. They were called road allowance communities. But as Canada continued to grow, the land was often violently taken back from the Métis for the expansion of railways, cities, and even farmland. In talking to Frank about his life in Roostertown, one thing becomes clear to me. Riel's government fought for land for the Métis to guarantee that their culture, their way of living, and community could remain intact, unblemished by the influence of settlers, some of whom just wanted the Indigenous people of Manitoba, both First Nation and Métis, to be dealt with, to vanish.
St. Martin, the community that's just in name. I was born and lived there for 4 years before we had to move.
That's Elder George Fleury, speaking at the Manitoba Museum for the opening of an exhibit on the place where he was born.
The reason we had to move is that we got chased out of the community.
St. Madeline was a Métis community located in southwestern Manitoba near the Saskatchewan border, not far from present-day Binscarth. It was a small community of 35 homes, a store, and a community school. But in the fall of 1938, all of that was burned to the ground as part of a federal government program to clear land and create pastures for settler farmers.
We'd been out.
George was only a young boy when this happened.
We'd been out as a family, out camping.
He and his family were away hunting, and that's when the authorities came in.
We'd come home and found that we didn't have a home. Our house had been burned down while we were gone. And it was a sad situation. I was only 4 years old, but I remember seeing my mother crying and my father's shoulders heaving up and down like that. I know he was crying too. I didn't sense what the loss was, but in their hearts they knew what had been lost. They lost their homes, their livelihood, and their dignity. I still feel sad when I think about my mother crying. I still feel sad when I visualize my father crying as well. They had lost everything. And as children, we had lost our playmates. We had to move. We were poor, core poor. Many nights we went to bed without nothing to eat. And I remember crying sometime because I was hungry. And it was a hard life. So the life of St. Madeleine and the existence and the residents that had to leave, I feel that sorry for them, because what used to be a cohesive community, people helping one another, was taken away from us also. As people dispersed from St. Madeleine, they went to different places and made a living for themselves. So the friendship that was there at the community of St. Madeleine kind of disappeared. And those of the people that were friends, hadn't seen each other for a while, they'd get drunk and start fighting, and then the friendship was torn apart. So the life of St. Madeleine was, I guess, hell on earth, you can say.
Something I've heard from elders during my research on this podcast is the idea that if you don't know where you come from, how can you know where you're going? As I learn more about the Métis people's history in Canada, I realize that land is an essential part of our identity. Having a strip of land to call home is not just an issue of Indigenous rights, but it's an important factor in maintaining a connection to community, a connection to culture. In my life, not many people have asked me where I'm from. I have fair skin, blue eyes, unlike my brother who could pass as Cree, and has been asked, "What are you? Where are you from?" That experience formed part of his identity, and I'm starting to think more about how my time spent in Lac St. Anne has formed mine.
I was always a child that was always searching, searching in my mind for the meaning of life.
That's Barbara Bruce, who we're about to meet in episode 4. Barbara grew up in St. Laurent, Manitoba, a Métis community that in some ways reminds me of Lac St. Anne, especially when it comes to its connection to the church.
We were very staunch Catholics, and I guess the relationship was what I knew. I don't know how to describe the relationship, because it's all I knew. Go to church every Sunday, and that's what we did.
The church pulls at another piece of Métis identity as we head into episode 4 and explore the attempts of Métis people to find community and sanctuary as Canada settled the West.
You know, it's 50 people is good.
Why worry?
It's a start.
I don't know.
People that come and enjoy themselves.
Back in Roostertown, or in the current context, back at the Pan Am Pool, a group of former residents and descendants of Roostertown gather to organize a reunion.
Thank you for sharing your shade.
Given the heaviness of history, they're not sure if they should call it a commemoration or a celebration, but regardless of the official wording, there's a sense of joy that comes up when people who know about Roostertown talk about it.
Good.
On even the most basic points, like,
where the heck did they get that name, Roostertown? Hey, so that one guy says to me, he says, oh, he says, there probably was a lot of chickens and that. And I said, no. I says, there was no chickens. There was no rooster. I says, there was one family had about 3 chickens and a rooster. That was it.
You know, there were shanty towns like this in, I think in 1951, 27 communities just in Manitoba. And there were shanty towns across the prairies and even some in BC. And they all had these colorful names, like Moccasin Flats or Little Chicago. So, I mean, there are all kinds of theories. I know Frank probably talked to you about the Roostertown being called Roostertown because either there were cockfights or there were roosters everywhere. But that seems highly unlikely. And other people thought that it was called Roostertown because that's where some of the railway workers roosted. But who knows?
I don't know. I wanna know the answer too. You know?
For Roostertown, the origins of the name aren't clear. Another muddy piece of history. And yet so many memories of Roostertown have survived. A testament of the importance of sharing stories among Métis people, but also to the resilience of the Métis nation.
The expedition arrives. They charge into Fort Garry, bayonet drawn, howling for blood.
After Confederation, a reign of terror was unleashed on Métis people, and it continues to impact Métis communities today.
Colonel Wolseley afterwards writes to his wife saying he was disappointed not to have found Riel in arms against Her Majesty, because nothing would have given him greater pleasure than to hang him from the nearest tree.
A history of reclamation and resistance. That's to come in Episode 4. This episode of Muddied Water is written and produced by Kim Kasher and me, Stephanie Cram. Janice Moeller is senior producer of audio, and Bertram Schneider is executive producer. You can subscribe to Muddied Water on your favorite podcast app or through the CBC Listen app.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.